Hi everybody, Carrie here with Rab for another episode of the Celtic Tales Chronicles. We hope everyone is having a great 2024. Quick trigger warning for this episode, we will be discussing murder and corpses. So if you're squeamish or eating your dinner right about now, be warned.
Yeah, I mean, some folk like murder and squeamishness when they're eating their dinner, so we embrace all strange things. Anyway, I'm Havering, and this second season, we've been looking at a lot of water-related subjects, from islands, cryptids, to islands, women, pirates. But for the next couple of episodes, we're going to take a deep dive into a bloodier sea tale, a tale of madness and murder from 1828.
We're going to be looking at the gruesome murders that took place on the Mary Russell, a cargo ship returning to Cork from Barbados, where it had taken mules for sale to plantation owners and was coming back, so it was returning with sugar to sell in Ireland. But before we jump in, we should mention that one of our main sources for this story was The Ship of Seven Murders, a true story of madness and murder. Written by Alana Hopkin and Kathy Bunny.
The Ship of Seven Murders, it's a fantastic read, and it's absolutely jam-packed with all the minute details of the events leading up to this awful event. So go get a copy now.
Run, don't walk. And as always, we have other sources as well. So check out our episode notes for more details. So, where do we start, Rab? With the lovely glow of a warm summer evening by the seaside, or the smell of rotting flesh.
Well, Perry, in this story, both go together. So let's start on the evening of 25th June 1828. There's two ships. I want you to visualize this. There's two ships, and they're sailing into Cork Harbour. A small, swift cutter, it's a wee boat, was sent out to help guide them in. The pilot of the cutter climbs up into one ship, which is called the Mary Stubbs, and speaks to its captain, Robert Callender. The captain informed him that he'd had to put three of his sailors on the other ship to help steer it home. That other ship was the Mary Russell.
It was a clear summer evening, and I'm pretty sure that the pilot would have quickly realized that there was something amiss. There was an awful silence among the sailors, and as he guided the two ships into harbour, he began to learn the full truth of what had happened aboard the Mary Russell.
It was an appalling tale. But we know human nature. Things of horror both repel us and attract us. We need to see, we need to know, are things truly as awful as we've heard they are?
That's so true, Rob. I tend to listen to true crime podcasts, and you tell gruesome tales at the Celtic Tales live shows. So we've both got a bit of an interest in the darker sides of humanity.
Yeah, so yeah, the pilot's just doing what humans do. We get curious about
Curious,
the
yeah.
macabre. Yeah. So once the ships were safely anchored off Cove, the pilot made his way onto the Mary Russell.
The reek of putrefying bodies was thick and choking as he made his way aboard and went to the broken skylight that overlooked the main saloon of the ship. And there is where he saw this gory, appalling scene. From that angle, it would have been difficult to see all the bodies, but he would have seen and smelled enough. There were a lot of bodies with horrific wounds. And they were already beginning to bloat with gas as they decomposed, fluid dripping from their mouths and noses, and thick, blackening blood everywhere.
Word quickly spread along the harbour, and from Cork it spread and seeped like spilt blood across the rest of Ireland. There were bodies, excuse me, there were bodies, seven bodies, bound and slaughtered in the saloon of the Mary Russell. But who were the dead? Who had survived? How did such horror happen?
To begin to answer or attempt to answer these questions, we need to go back 5 months to early February when the Mary Russell sailed out from Cove on a routine voyage to transport mules to Barbados in the Caribbean, or Caribbean, depending on where you're from. The ship and its crew and passengers appeared well, happy, and expectant. Transatlantic voyages were becoming less common, so this voyage would provide employment for the crew and profit for the traders who were using it to import and export goods to the West Indies. It would also be a great opportunity for young apprentices to learn the necessary skills to further their seafaring careers. So, pretty great for everyone involved at the time.
Yeah, and yeah, the ship, this journey was a very important voyage. And before we kind of get into it, it's good to reflect on what made Cork so important for the Irish economy, trade, and employment. So, over the course of the 18th century, the Irish economy became increasingly enmeshed in the Atlantic slave trade. So while the main centres of the British slave trade were Liverpool, Bristol, and London, Irish cities like Cork benefited from the massive expansion of salted and pickled foodstuffs being exported to the West Indies to feed plantation owners and enslaved people. In return, sugar from the Caribbean and tobacco from North America poured into Ireland. Many Irish of various religious and political affiliations became wealthy as a result of this. By the third quarter of the 18th century, the Irish made up 12% of the crews on slave ships, and Scots made up 9%.
Cork had also benefited from the Napoleonic Wars, which again sucked up men and impacted on farming as salted beef became a staple for the British Navy. Cork, being a huge natural seaport, and doing the research, Rab informed me that Cork is actually the second largest natural harbour in the world, which is crazy.
That's
So,
kind of
this,
wild.
yeah, I, you always jumping off base here. I forget
Yeah.
that there's like interesting stuff about Ireland all the time because when you grow up here, you don't think anything of it. The second largest port in the world, that's amazing. So, yeah, this harbour was vital to the interests of the British Empire. During the Napoleonic Wars, it was a base for the British Navy, who were enforcing, the blockade of France at the time. And towers, forts, and a shipyard were all built there. So, it was a pretty important location.
Yeah, it was buzzing. I mean, it was just that it was like really fundamental to a lot of things that were going on in the 18th century, but this is now the beginning of the 19th century. So Cork was a vital economic and defence hub, and it would be that again at some point. However, by the time the Mary Russell set sail for Barbados on the 8th of February, the shipping trade had slumped, the slave trade had ended. Now, I was thinking, I remember hearing somewhere that you couldn't have a transatlantic slave trade, but there were still actually slaves for a few more years in Barbados, so that was still going on there anyway. Anyway, and so, but the actual trade in slaves has finished. A lot of those plantations were now kind of make their own beef and stuff. There was peace with France. And so there was no longer this huge amount of ships travelling across the ocean bringing beef and other goods to the navy or plantations.
And this is exactly why getting employment on the Mary Russell was such a great deal, because it provided income and also kept men and boys using their skills and, remaining sharp in anticipation of better times and opportunities. So there was definitely a positive feel about the ship, the crew, and the passengers as it sailed out of Cork Harbour. So, who were these aforementioned men and boys, Rab?
To start with, there was a captain, Captain William Stewart, and he had a reputation as a good and humane man, probably fairly rare at the time. He did not use flogging as a punishment, preferring to punish men by tying them up to a mast as a way of humiliating them. I'm not sure how that counts as humane, but within Measuring it
It's,
against
I'd rather
flogging.
be embarrassed than flogged, to be honest.
Fair enough. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So that's it. He would use tying and humiliating. And this tying and humiliating is something we're going to discuss in the second episode in this series because it's quite important. His chief mate was a Scotsman, William Smith, and his second mate was a local Swedish guy called William Swanson.
Okay, so three willies in charge of a ship. What could possibly go wrong?
In charge, three willies in charge of a lot of seamen. That's all I'm trying to
It's
say.
the
What?
18 plus
Moving
pirate
on.
episode.
Just has to be said. Anyway, there was four crew. Three of them were called John.
Amazing.
Elvis had not yet been born, so names were limited, obviously, in the West,
That's it. They could only
Southwest of
afford
Ireland
a
at
few
the time.
names.
Yeah.
So
So
John
there was those
Kramer was,
guys.
yes. So John Kramer was the carpenter, which was obviously a vital role on a wooden ship. Lots of repairs and maintenance were needed on the regular. And then there was John Howe, seaman, Francis Sullivan, seaman, and John Keating, seaman. Take a shot every
Wait,
time I
how?
say the word seaman. Sea
Wait.
man, man of the sea.
Man of the sea!
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Man of the sea. Mariner. Very good.
Yeah. Oh, damn, we should
Okay.
have used that. Ah, well.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. I'm going to pause for a moment just to kind of reflect. Okay.
Reflect
And
on our
then,
life choices.
yeah, life choices. And we're going to consider who else is on the ship. Okay. Because, all right. You know what? Before we actually consider who else is on the ship, let's have a wee think about other things that were going on. Because whilst everything seemed very positive on board, and everybody's excited that they're getting work and experience in this kind of slump, there was already a bit of tension amongst these men, these Willies and Johns, and tensions that at first glance could be overlooked as just a normal back and forth between men about to go on a long sea journey.
So one issue was the choice of first mate and second mate. It was understandable why Captain Stewart had chosen William Smith as first mate because they were both ex-Navy men who had previously sailed together. However, the choice of William Swanson, the Swedish sailor, as second mate was a little bit strange.
Yeah, because there's John Howes, and he's a local seaman who had decades of experience and was older than anybody else except the captain. He wanted to be second mate. It was a natural progression in his career. It was not chosen. And this added just a little bit more of that tension between who was officers and who was crew. But there was another division that we'll talk about later, but I think for now, let's just talk about John House for a bit.
He's an interesting person. He was hoping to be the second mate, as Rab said, but this didn't work out. But he was still interested in improving himself as a mariner. He was interested in mastering the skill of celestial navigation, that is, working out the location of a ship on the ocean by the position of celestial objects, the moon, the sun, the stars, in relationship to each other and to the horizon. Very important when you're in the middle of the ocean.
Absolutely, and this is a vital skill for seafaring. On land, you have the landscape to judge where you are. There's that mountain with the river flowing west, so I know I'm da 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 here. But on the ocean, there's nothing. Just this absolute vastness of nothing. So you need to know where you are to work out how close you are to your destination or to other possible destinations.
However, this celestial navigation is a skill that many captains guarded jealously. For a captain to have absolute control of a ship, he needs to have absolute control of the data about where it is. Otherwise, he is vulnerable to being replaced by the crew. If only the captain can steer or work out where they are, they can't exactly have a mutiny and kill him. if they want to make it back home alive.
On the other hand, some captains understood the benefits of sharing those skills. What if the captain took out his rank and incapacitated? I am not American. Incapacitated. It wasn't well. And, so who's going to navigate then if he's gathering all this data? Who would work out where the ship was then? So there are benefits to sharing skills.
And it also made sense to teach these skills to people who someday might be in charge of a ship. Whatever the reason, Captain Stewart encouraged John Howe's curiosity in celestial navigation, and he did promise to teach him the craft on the journey back from the Bahamas.
So, while there was some tension between John Howes and the captain, on the journey to the Bahamas, it seems to have eased. John's trying to work out how to navigate. Captain's kind of encouraging it. The relationship seems like everything else in the ship, everything seems positive. But as we mentioned earlier, even from the beginning of the journey, there was another division, a fracture line between the officers and many, in fact, most of the crew, and that would play a part in the horror that was to come.
And it wasn't as simple as just a case of Willie's versus Johnny's. Oh no.
Oh
There was
no.
something there was something far more fundamental to this division. The captain, the mate, and second mate were all English-speaking Protestants.
Which is perfectly fine.
Absolutely. However, this meant that the crew were predominantly Irish-speaking Catholics. Of course, the Irish speakers were bilingual, because they had to be, colonialism, so they could understand the officers perfectly. However, the officers on the ship could only understand the crew when they were speaking English.
Captain Stewart belonged to the ruling Protestant caste in Ireland, and the position of this caste had been under threat for some time now. Only 30 years before the Mary Russell set sail on its fateful journey, Ireland had been rocked by the bloody insurrection of 1798.
That's a big and still contentious subject, but in summary, it began with both Presbyterians and Catholics uniting to create an independent Ireland where no faith would be dominant and where there would be universal suffrage for all men. The main fighting took place in Ulster and Wexford, and it was put down with brutal savagery. Though the rebellion lasted only 3 months, it is estimated that between 10,000 and 70,000 people were killed. There were appalling acts of sectarian violence on all sides, one result of which was that many Presbyterians came to view Anglicans as less of a threat than Catholics.
And that's the kind of the faith of the dominant ruling caste at the time, version of Protestantism. And then after the rebellion, Britain realised the colonial parliament in Ireland, which had been set up to govern the English and their descendants in Ireland, was no longer fit for the job. Through bribes and threats, they persuaded the parliament to abolish itself. The nominally independent colony of Ireland would become united with Britain, with London now having complete control.
To soften the blow of direct rule, Britain had promised rights for Catholics. But by 1828, the vast majority of Irish were still excluded from many positions of economic and political influence. One example of this is that Catholics could stand for election, for no point really, though, as they were still barred from sitting in British Parliament. From the early 1820s on, huge meetings were taking place across Ireland demanding Catholic emancipation. These were led by Daniel O'Connell, the Liberator. Not to be confused with the beloved crooner from Donegal, Daniel O'Donnell. And though the movement refuted violence, tension was once more building up in Ireland as the Protestant ruling class looked on fearfully.
There's absolutely no doubt the whole issue of Catholic emancipation was a topic of conversation for everybody at this time, whether it was the ruling caste or Irish Catholics. And there's definitely a sense that this was reflected in across Ireland, but even in something as simple as a ship, we have a ruling caste, ruling faith, ruling language, as the officers of a ship where, the crew were predominantly Catholic and bilingual. And this would undoubtedly impact on the later bloody events.
But even among the three officers, there were. Say that again. But even among the three officers, there were still tensions. Originally, William Swanson was to have been first mate and William Smith second mate. But there had been some form of argument between Swanson and the captain, so the Swede was demoted to second mate, which meant he no longer shared a cabin with the captain. William Smith was made first mate and did share the cabin. Basically, the three Willies just kept changing positions.
We're just going to move on from that and mention nothing about mariners. Okay. All right. However, just to add to the tension, William Smith had a secret that was not good. No, it was not good at all. And he's harboring this secret. And
His secret was this. When he was a younger man, still serving in the Navy, he was anchored off the southeast of England. There, he had helped murder a marine and had got away with it. We don't know anything about this killing, but I imagine it would have been fairly easy to cover up. Did Smith and his fellow murderers pretend it was an accident? Or had they shoved the corpse overboard, man overboard? No CCTV in those days, you see.
I'd imagine there would be a lot of ways you could get away with murdering a ship, as long as you and your fellow murderers all agree to stick to one story and back each other up. But it does make you think, had this killing preyed on the Scotsman's mind all that time? Had it gnawed away at him? Or had he simply shrugged it off, only to have the guilt flare up on the Mary Russell? And why did he confess on that return trip from Barbados?
I suppose what we're trying to say here is that there was a lot simmering beneath the surface of the crew on this journey. But we still have not mentioned the other people on board the ship. So, in addition to the crew, there were three apprentices. They were the sons of local Protestant families. So, again, in terms of faith, language, social position, they were closer to the officers than to the crew.
I'm not holding that against them. They were young lads. They'd not created this world they'd been born into. They were John Deaves, aged 15, Henry Richards, aged 12, Daniel Scully, aged 13, and there was another younger boy, an invalid, Thomas Hammond, aged 11, and he was the son of the captain's close friend. He was on the voyage to recuperate from sickness and possibly benefit from the heat of the Caribbean.
And this brings us to the final two people on this voyage. Timothy Connell and James Morley were ostlers, whose job was to look after the ship's cargo of mules. Both Timothy and James were Irish speakers, with James having very little English. The journey out would take 6 weeks, and the two lads would have to look after the mules, feeding, watering, and cleaning up their shit. Lovely.
Lovely stuff. So the ship set out on the February the 8th, cold winter's day. But as we said, there was reason for optimism. The ship was travelling towards warmer latitudes and warmer days. The men had work to do, which would hopefully lead to more employment in the future, even promotion. The apprentices were learning skills to become future officers. The sick boy would hopefully benefit from a break in Barbados.
Basically, they were all on a cruise to Barbados. What could possibly go wrong? Tune in to the next episode and part two to find out how things turned very bloody, very fast.
Then it should be. Should we give them? listeners some clues as to what is going to happen.
No clues, however, I will give one caveat. I imagine a lot of listeners will be worrying over who is going to die. So I think we can assure them that absolutely no mules are to be harmed in this story.
Thank goodness. I can hear our listeners breathing a collective sigh of relief. The mules are safe.
And one more thing. We have not mentioned everybody who travelled on the Mary Russell. There will be a person joining them in Barbados. And no, it's not Rihanna.
Is that a clue?
I'm saying nothing.
So, listeners, stay tuned. What is going to happen? Did the mules go on a killing spree? Find out soon. Du-du-du.
Duh, duh, duh. Thank you so much. For listening, everybody. You can get tickets to the Celtic Tales live shows in the Eventbrite link in the episode notes. Our socials are there too. And yeah, do do
Yeah, they can
do.
listen. Do they can listen to you and your other podcast.
Yes, I am producing a limited series for Ethereal Magazine here in Galway. The name of the podcast is Aisht, E-I for the S-T. You can find links to it on my socials, and I would really appreciate a listen and a share. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Do you have any news before we finish up?
Any news? I got my first haircut in 8 years this year. I got
Ah,
it
it looks
in early
amazing.
March. Thank you so much. So yeah, my hair is no longer past my bum. Now it's just to my hip, which to me feels like a bob. It's funny. I have like curly, wavy sort of hair, so it's shorter when I wear it naturally. So I guess I feel like it's a lot shorter than it is, but when I straighten it or whatever, it's still fairly long. But yeah, I kind of woke up one day and was like, you know what? It's time to do it. It's been 8 years. Haven't had a haircut since I was in my first year of university, and I'm 27 now, so let's go. Let's do it.
That's just wow, that's amazing. That's
Yeah.
yeah. I'm having this weird thing. I am 57. My hair was thinning, but my hair's actually suddenly going through a thickening thing. It's thickening up and it's also
Very
going, it
good.
was going grey and now it's darkening. I don't know. There's something that maybe with my diet or something, but my hair is having its own. It's having its
Interesting.
own wonderful emotional journey, which is very nice.
I
And talking
think,
emotional. Yes,
yeah.
go. Yeah, what you say.
I think I did notice that. I'd noticed because when you got your hair cut the last time, I was like, yeah, you've got a good lot of hair. And I'm comparing
Yeah.
it, I suppose, to my father, who's around the same age as you, and I think he started going bald at like 19. Like he's always had not much hair, but he pulls it off. He makes it work.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a lot of young fellas nowadays. The fear is losing their hair. And I'm just here to say, get hair plugs, get a hair transplant. There's no shame in it. Why
Wear a
not?
hat. Wear
Wear
a
a
hat.
hat.
Wear a bag over your head with the
Perfect.
little
Just with
bits cut out for
eye
your eyes.
holes. Yeah.
Lean into it and
Do.
celebrate being bald.
Yeah.
Draw pictures on your head. You could
Yeah. Tattoo hair
a lot of
on.
things.
You could get a wig.
Yeah.
There's just plenty of things to do. But
Yeah.
yeah, that's
Bon.
my
Yeah.
big news, I guess, for this month. I've been pretty busy, but it's been good. It's been a nice sort of ease into spring, and the fact that, it's almost 9 o'clock in the evening as we're recording this and I'm looking outside and it's not pitch black, great for the mental health.
Yeah, definitely. We've been having a lot of fun. It's been a great, because I know you're busy with a lot of stuff, but you're also busy looking after the show as well. The crowd control, the show is going a bit. The
Yeah,
show's
we've
been
been
going,
packed, super
oh,
busy.
packed
If you're
out
looking to
since
come,
February.
guys, buy tickets on Eventbrite because we can't guarantee you'll get in if you're buying a ticket on the door. It's been so
Yeah.
busy. Rab is
Yeah.
a in-demand kind of guy.
I think they're coming to see the person on the door, Kerry. I think there's definitely, yeah, I think so. I'll tell you what, my other news before we head off, I went to see a wonderful movie the day, and you know what? My apologies to everybody who made the movie. I think it's Ayo Capitano. If I got that wrong, I apologize. It's on the Palace Cinema just now. Go and see it. It's beautiful. It's about these two Senegalese lads are like 16 and they're trying to get to Europe. And oh, it's harrowing in bits, but it's also very
Wow.
beautiful. And the chemistry between these two actors, they feel like buddies. You can feel it really, their
Yeah.
acting is amazing. And I really loved it. So that's my news. There you go. I think that's all the news
Go
this
see
week,
this
yeah.
film. Yeah, there's that's it. I think so. We haven't been on any pirate ships since, so fingers crossed it stays that
Oh,
way.
fingers crossed. Yeah. All right, Kerry, we will do more blood. Well, the next episode's going to get quite gory, just giving folk a bit of warning. But of course, it's a bit of mass murder, it has to be. So tune in, everybody. If you like the show, rate and review. And thank you, everybody who has rated and reviewed so far. Brilliant feedback. Thank yous. It helps generate more listeners. And
Absolutely.
yeah, that's us. So slán.
That's us. Slam. The Celtic Tales Chronicles is written, hosted, and produced by Kerry Graham and Rab Fulton. Edited by Rab Fulton. Cover artwork by Kerry Graham. Music by Kevin MacLeod.